When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, I'm getting confused. We've had an extra pod already this week, and we may have another one to come tomorrow. So I'm having to remind myself that today is the news pod, and I need reminding. I need reminding where you are at the moment, Kieran.
I'm in Timperley, the home of Frank Sidebottom.
Oh.
So it's a very honourable place to be in. There's a statue of Frank, which was put up by the locals, and it's next to the laundrette I used to go to as well. So yeah, it's very rock and roll for me.
Oh, don't tell Debbie McGee. Anybody under the age of 30, I urge you to YouTube Frank Sidebottom. You will not have ever seen anything. I knew him very vaguely, but that act. This seems an odd thing to say, Kieran, but he was a different man when he put that giant papier-mâché mask on. He was quiet and reserved, but fascinating. Kieran, it is a big news week. And the first story, Kieran, I mean, you barely have time to breathe as it is, Kieran, but we know how excited you get when accounts come out, and the accounts don't get bigger than these, Kieran, do they?
That's right. It's our very good friends at FIFA.
Really? Do we have very good friends? Who are the people we don't like then at FIFA?
Oh no! We feel FIFA as Gianni Infantino would say. I think these accounts show exactly why FIFA wants to muscle in on the territory of the likes of UEFA, because what we've seen is the revenue of FIFA went up from $760 million to $5.76 billion on the back of the World Cup. And you think that they earned that effectively over 4 weeks. Such is the appeal of the competition. And from a footballing point of view, it was a great competition. And from a money-raising point of view, it's absolutely fantastic for FIFA as well. Yes, they've got hosting costs, but they do all right themselves, because they made of that $5.7 billion that they generated in revenue, that they've had to clearly have some costs in terms of hosting and their relationship with Qatar FA, and that makes sense. They've had to give compensation to the clubs because they're effectively borrowing the players for a month. But even so, it doesn't make a huge dent. So they made a profit of $2.3 billion on that $5.7 billion. And then when you read the small print, they paid tax at 0.9% on their profits, which I think quite a few institutions would like to do. And part of the reason for this is that FIFA is a registered charity. And when it goes to a country and say, yeah, I know you want to host the World Cup, can we just agree a few things? One of which is, if you do win the World Cup, one of the things we insist on is that we are effectively have charitable status during the course of the tournament. So we don't pay any taxes to you. I think quite often the players don't pay any taxes to you as well. And that's why it works out very well. And they extend that a bit, because I taught a course for FIFA 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I'll be honest, I was quite chuffed to be asked to do it. And at the end of it, they said, thank you very much. I really enjoyed that, so on. So, and I sort of, yeah, I'm, you know me, I'm I'm a bit polite and I'm not very good at pushing myself forwards on things. So I was sort of hanging round, sort of, we've not sort of sorted out the fee for this and expenses and so on. And then he said, yeah, thanks very much. We're FIFA. It's a charity. So we're assuming you're doing it on a pro bono basis.
What?
So I go, oh, okay, mate. So that was it.
I did a benefit for a charity on Monday night, kid. I'm happy to do so for nothing because it's a lovely charity that I know very well. It's not FIFA. You don't work for nothing, right? I'm slightly disappointed that they asked you to work for them, Kieran, because it indicates to me they don't listen to the pod.
Yes. Oh, well, I think we're fair. We say that FIFA does a hell of a lot of good work around the world in terms of individual projects, and I think that gets mixed up with some of the issues in terms of governance and transparency with regards to the awarding of the tournament the way that the executives behave, which is a bit disturbing. And talking of executives, congratulations to Gianni Infantino, who got 460,000 in 2018 for the World Cup in Qatar, and he must have done extremely well over the last 4 years because he got quadruple that. He got $1.7 million. Wow. £1.7 million salary, and he's also been awarded a £1.4 million bonus.
Wow.
On top for something. Didn't he achieve world peace during the course of the tournament? You know, he suggested to Russia and Ukraine that they stop hostilities and allow people to watch the football. I don't think that quite worked, but no, I guess he got the bonus. It's the thought that counts, isn't it?
Well, see, he's the boss, Kieran, so he probably just nodded it through without checking the technicalities of what was still going on. Exactly what I would do if ever I was the boss of anything and my inbox had a $1.4 million bonus, I'd probably nod it through as well, Kieran, without checking to see there'd been a mistake.
Yes. So they've had a very good year, but the problem is it's now 2023, and we've got the FIFA Women's World Cup, which in Australia and New Zealand, which I think will be a great tournament, and I'm really looking forward to cheering on the Lionesses, and I'm going to see the Lionesses play Brazil in a couple of months. So that's something to really look forward to. But the value of the TV rights is considerably lower. So this is why FIFA is so keen to have a significantly expanded FIFA World Cup.
Yeah.
Because we've just had the Club World Cup. We've just seen that in respect of Real Madrid won it a couple of weeks ago. And I only realized because somebody mentioned it on the telly. I didn't even know the tournament had taken place.
Yeah.
So FIFA have seen how successful UEFA are with regards to the Champions League, and they want a slice of the action. And it could very well work. I think they'll have to work hard to capture the imagination of the public, but we'll see how that goes. But I do think it could open up a much broader issue, because we have been talking about multi-club ownership and the potential issues that could arise if, for example, there are deemed to be links between the owners of PSG and Manchester United if there's a Qatari takeover. We know that Jim Ratcliffe, he owns a French club. Well, what happens if they draw Manchester United, if he buys Manchester United? And that's one thing, but quite a few of the multi-club ownership models extend out of Europe. And historically, it's never really been a problem, because you effectively have to be the champions of Europe, and you end up playing the champions of the other continents and so on. But if you expand the tournament to, say, 32 teams, you could have a scenario where you've got owners that have one club in Asia, another club in South America, another club in Europe. They're all owned by the same people. And I don't think FIFA has thought this through as yet, and that could impact upon the success or the integrity of the tournament going forwards.
A couple of questions, Kieran, on FIFA, if I may. First of all, historically, are they always dealt in US dollars?
Yes, Swiss francs or US dollars. Because FIFA is effectively an organisation relating to 200 different countries, the US dollar is the sort of backstop currency. Everybody knows the value of a dollar. So therefore, FIFA like to put out their accounts in dollars because they know it's the most universal of currencies. And therefore, if somebody is reading it in India, if somebody's reading it in Nigeria or Paraguay, then they've got a rough idea of what that would work, in what the numbers would work out in terms of the local currency.
Did they even pay? They didn't even pay expenses, FIFA.
No, they just said. I mean, to be fair, it was. I didn't ask for any, and it was. I was only popping up to London, so. But yeah, I was a bit. Oh, okay.
Actually, I mean, the Baroness would have been expecting a bottle of champagne at the very least, Kieran. Not you coming home.
Well, she probably will get one because if she finds out that I've done it for nothing, I think I might have to. I might be on the naughty step.
Well, as we know, Kieran, for some reason, neither the Baroness nor Ali listened to this pod. I don't know why. Historical reasons. Secondly, Kieran, you mentioned that the tax figure, 0.9%, was tucked away in the small print where only you would read it. In a non-World Cup year, who are they paying 0.9% tax to? Which government is collecting tax from?
It would be the Swiss government. I mean, the way that the Swiss system works, and if Swiss Ramble is listening, which he probably isn't because he's far too highbrow for this, but he will probably confirm that individual Swiss cantons have different rates of tax, and that's one way of attracting organisations to different parts of Switzerland itself. But it would normally be in Switzerland because that's where FIFA is based.
I don't know how to break this to you, Kieran, but we've just discussed two people who we know definitely don't listen to the pod. I think there's probably three people who definitely don't listen to the pod, and you just mentioned the third one. And finally, Kieran, how extensive are these accounts? I mean, are they talking about things like futsal and the more minor things that FIFA look after as well?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, they're very glossy. They are very inclusive. That they are detailed. And futsal, if anybody's not seen it, is absolutely brilliant to watch. It's ridiculously skillful. Although I think if you were, say, Mickey Droy, I wouldn't recommend taking it up.
Mickey Droy was 6'4". I think he was an ex-bin man, wasn't he? I don't care what lack of skill he has. He'd still dominate that. Kieran, we often talk about this next club, a club that mysteriously seems to have loads of money while losing loads of money, but they're paying a lot of money to a slightly strange company.
Yes. And I've not got my script in front of me.
I'm talking, Kieran. Yeah, every now and again we have people listening to this show who don't really know a lot about football. And we try to weed them out by my clever introductions. Barcelona, Kieran. We're talking about Barcelona.
Oh yes. Sorry, yes. Let me.
What are you doing this from memory, Kieran? You're improvising.
Yeah, I'm because I'm staying in Timperley. I don't have all of my normal bits and pieces in front of me.
Why? Are there different rules in Timperley about laptops?
That's right. I think it's more to do with the fact that I'm ridiculously disorganised. But I've just found my piece of paper now. Great. Yes, this is our very good friends in Barcelona who, one of the architects of Super League, a club which has been subject to financial repercussions from La Liga. And now, and this is this actually, as many things do, remember Al Capone ended up in the clink because of this. This came about because of a tax inspection. And it's a company which is run by a former senior referee in La Liga. And there were some strange invoices which didn't have any details on, but they were made out to Barcelona Football Club. And the tax authorities said, what exactly, you know, you don't write out these. And it started off to be £1 million. And I don't think it's crept up now over the years to be about £4 to £5 million. And it's covering a long period of time. When Barcelona were asked about, you know, why are you paying a company owned by a former senior referee? Effectively, it's somebody that sort of organises referees. It was sort of a very vague. We advise football clubs about referees, and you go, what exactly do you mean you advise? Well, yeah, we advise them as to, you know, whether the referee is trigger happy, what type of things he dislikes most, and so on. And I'm thinking to myself, well, all you've got to do is to watch three or four matches, and you know which referees are tolerant and which are more likely to hand out cards, and so on. So it's all now starting to get just a little bit uncomfortable, I think, for Barcelona, who are sort of, you know, whistling in the dark with regards to this, and sort of just pretending that nothing's happened. But if you've paid, you know, a sizable amount to a company of a former referee, and he then sort of said, oh, but you know, this advice wasn't given by me, it was given by my son.
What?
And I'm going, it just, you know, the more he starts digging a hole for himself, the worse it looks. So Barcelona, I think, are open to a bit of an investigation here, potentially, because it look, you know, the optics here look terrible. And there's no evidence or suggestion of corruption in terms of referees. And, you know, for all of the stick that referees get, of which, you know, a little bit is perhaps justified, the vast majority isn't. The one thing which always galls me is, as somebody who used to referee at, you know, low-level football, is I might be crap, but I'm not corrupt. And I think, you know, that's the thing which I think upsets referees. Yeah, referees make mistakes, and, you know, some mistakes are bigger than others, but they're genuine, honest mistakes. And I was looking at some postings by somebody who said, you know, that they should be sacked for making mistakes. Okay, well, that's very harsh, because, you know, let's take Robert Sanchez, Alisson, and Thino Courtois, all of whom have made absolute rickets in the last couple of weeks, which have cost their club's goals. But you wouldn't say sack a goalkeeper because he drops the ball at the feet of a striker. So you know, to say sacking a referee. So referees are not corrupt in the vast majority of instances, in the vast majority of countries. We know that that isn't universal, but as far as European football is concerned, I think the integrity of the sport is there. But this does simply, it asks more questions than the answers we're getting. And Barcelona are very much on the defensive with regards to this. And the former referee, he's looking coming out of this, I've earned a lot of money from this, and doesn't really have a viable explanation. You know, why would a referee advise a club? And you know, from the club's point of view, they must realise that it just looks terrible. So it's messy. It's involving large sums of money, and, you know, for a club which many people of a sort of a liberal persuasion have historically quite liked for their opposition, you know, their representation of sort of the Catalan nation, they are becoming increasingly grubby with the way that they behave.
I mean, it almost beggars belief, Kieran, that La Liga, if they knew about this, and you'd imagine they would allow this company to, is it? I mean, obviously it's a decent potential career opportunity for Lee Mason, but it's incredible to think that there could be anything other than skullduggery involved in this going. Although I do like the idea of when you were refereeing in the Junior Northern Accountants League, or whatever it was, somebody paying a former referee 50 quid to find out, yeah, the ref on Sunday is colourblind. Thank you very much. We'll tell you that. Wimbledon famously made no secret of the fact that they got somebody at the club to research the referee so that when the Justin Fashanu, whoever was captain that week, was tossing the coin, he'd say to the ref, oh, how's your daughter's ballet lessons going? Or, got any new fish for that tank? And the ref would be so friendly for the next 5 minutes, they got away with murder. So, I mean, that's quite clever in a way, but I don't think Wimbledon were paying money for it. That's one we'll definitely have to keep an eye on.
Yes.
In the West Midlands, Kieran, some unexpected blues for City.
Yes. This is a press release from the EFL. And it's clearly been through a few sets of lawyers before it was published. So it's quite neutral, but it is making reference to persons or people unknown or known in relation to a takeover bid, which didn't take place. But for those people unfamiliar, there's a former Argentinian player called Maxi Lopez, and he was involved with a local businessman, I think his name's Paul Richardson, with regards to a takeover, and to a certain extent, that they seemed to be acting as if they'd bought the club. They were certainly being photographed at times down at St Andrews. And I think the fans rightly got quite excited at the prospect of having somebody in charge of Birmingham, because the current owners trying to work out whether they're based in Hong Kong, then there's other companies connected in other countries as well. It's all very messy and murky. Part of Birmingham's ground has been closed down. There's been no money spent in terms of infrastructure. And also there's been rumours of Matt Southall being linked to this possible takeover. And Matt Southall, for people who aren't familiar with his background, he was in charge of Charlton Athletic for a few months. And during that period of time, I think it's fair to say that the expenses went through the roof in terms of the cost of running the club. And he fell out with the fellow owner. And Charlton have had nothing but bad luck in terms of a sort of a merry-go-round of owners and non-owners and possible owners, in a pretty much rogue's gallery. I'd say that his period of tenureship was possibly the worst. You know, they Charlton fans didn't like Roland de Chachelet because they didn't feel he put enough money into the club, but at least he wasn't taking money out of the club in the way that we saw with Matt Southall in terms of on lifestyle issues. So. There is now a concern that in respect of this potential takeover, the appropriate actions were not taken. And there's a genuine fear that this could result in a points deduction. We will have to wait for the investigation to take due process. But it's not looking great from Birmingham's point of view. And it's another classic case of, you know, the fans now live in a period of uncertainty. The fans themselves have done nothing to cause this, but it's difficult for the EFL to financially fine people that didn't actually own the club, because the EFL don't really have any rights as such with regards to that. So therefore, what else do they have as a course of action? There could be financial sanctions against the club, or we could have a points deduction. And remember, Birmingham did have a points deduction a couple of years ago in relation to signing a player during a period in which they weren't supposed to be signing players. So they've had nothing but bad luck. And as somebody that loves a trip to Birmingham, I just hope it gets sorted out ASAP.
I love St Andrews. I've had some lovely times there. But can you just give me some actual clarity here, Kieran? And I think Birmingham City fans would like it as well. You've indicated that clearly these are serious alleged rule breaches. But reading the press release from the EFL, which, as you say, was circumspect, it seemed to me that investigating the potential new owners uncovered historic issues. Am I right? Is that a fair reading of?
Yes. That's certainly the way it came across. Why Maxi Lopez was involved in the first place is something nobody can quite work out. I think Paul Richardson was sort of, to a certain extent, a bystander in all of this. But there are issues, and there's a Birmingham fan called Daniel who is an absolute sleuth when it comes to trying to work out the exact nature of Trillion, which is sort of the company which was involved in terms of the present owners, as to who exactly owns that. And I don't think the EFL are particularly comfortable in trying to trace. Ultimately, you've got to have one person or a group of people who are responsible for owning the club. And the paper trail sort of disappears at times. So I think that you're absolutely right. It's not just this takeover bid, but the EFL the EFL have certainly upped their game in the last few years in terms of trying to protect clubs from unscrupulous owners. And the position at Birmingham is certainly one of discomfort.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Talking of takeovers, you have mentioned it briefly. What is the latest on the Man United ownership bid?
Well, it's acting in a very strange manner, because we've got two parties who have come out and are waving their arms around. We've got Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who is historically born in Manchester. He says he's been a lifelong Manchester United fan, although he also had a season ticket at Chelsea, and I find that a bit odd. Yeah. And he's been sort of very vocal to say, this is a Manchester bid for a Manchester club. And I think that's the route that he's going down. And then we had the appearance of Sheikh Jassim, who is not connected to the Qatari Sports Investment Fund, as he is very at pains to put out. But, this isn't a criticism of Qatar. Qatar is a country in which there is rule by decree. So in such a governmental structure, you normally have to have approval before anything significant takes place. Now, by all accounts, Sheikh Jassim's, his family are very, very wealthy, very, very successful. I think he was at Sandringham. He knows banking. He knows the world of finance, and his family were sort of part of the strategy for Qatar investments in London itself, from a property point of view, from which the Qatari authorities have done extremely well, because we know the London property market is very buoyant. So those are the two potential bidders that we're aware of. But then over sort of the course of the weekend, there's lots of stuff being strategically leaked. There were sort of these rumbles coming from, the Glazers aren't very happy that there's been talk about restoring Manchester United to its former glories, with the sort of the implication that Manchester United were not successful under the Glazers. And it, you know, there's a lot of reasons to potentially dislike the Glazers, and I'm more than happy to give them criticism. But yeah, they did win. Manchester United did win the Champions League under the period of the Glazers' ownership, and I think they've won the Premier League as well, three or four times as well. In addition, so it's not been a period of zero success. It has been a period of very little success since Sir Alex Ferguson retired, and there's a case for saying that it was Sir Alex Ferguson sort of compensated for some of the complications caused by the Glazers, and when he left, there was nobody left to paper over the cracks. So that's what we've got in terms of public, and then sort of the noises were, oh, the Glazers are now thinking about not selling or only selling a smaller amount of the company, and in addition, they are now looking to. They're now looking to perhaps raise some funds privately with a view to revamping Old Trafford, which is something they've spoken vaguely about before. But and this could be them positioning themselves, because it looks as if the bids which have come in have not matched their expectations. They were hoping to get £6 to 8 billion for Manchester United. I think the bids which have come in are probably in the region of 4.5. There's probably room to tweak a bit more out of them. But I don't think they've been over happy with the extent of the bids. Now, in my view, £6 to 8 billion is you're paying an awful lot for the name. And Manchester United is a fantastic name in the worlds of sports brands. There's no doubt about that. And it would, at that level, certainly make Manchester United the most expensive sale of a sports club stroke franchise in the history of all sports. And that includes American NBA and NFL franchises as well. Are there other offers? Well, if there are, they're keeping their mouths shut. Then that could be due to the fact that the Rain Group, who are the advisors to the Glazer family, they've asked people to sign NDAs. I believe that the serious bidders have had an opportunity to see what is referred to as the data room, which is all the details of the contracts of Manchester United, the sponsorship arrangements, player contracts, wage commitments, future sort of contingent payments in respect of add-ons. So I think they have had access to this. And sort of the noises that I'm getting is that part of the reason why the bids haven't been as big as the Glazer family would have liked was that the people that have seen that information have gone, oh, yeah, they've been a bit underwhelmed,
right?
In terms of the sort of the guaranteed incomes, but also the committed costs in terms of Manchester United. And remember, whoever does buy the club, should it be sold, does have this further elephant in the room in the form of having to find a substantial amount of money to address the Old Trafford issue, because Old Trafford is not a 21st century stadium if you're a regular fan. The facilities are poor.
Excuse me. To be fair to Jim Ratcliffe, Kieran, he may have had a season ticket at Chelsea just to make sure he got a ticket for the Man United away game. He could afford
it. Yes.
What do the Glazers do, Kieran? If the Glazers, do they decide, right, if we're not getting £6 to 8 billion, we're not selling, or do they bite the bullet and accept the highest bid?
I think they are more likely to reject a takeover. I mean, both Sir Jim Ratcliffe is looking to acquire the shares owned by the Glazers, which would mean that there's 31% of the shares, which would not be sold to him. I think he's also looking to potentially borrow money to acquire those shares, which won't go down well with Manchester United fans, because they've had a sense of unease with regards to the amount of debt at the club. So the Glazers might sell. They might do something similar to what we're expecting to see at Liverpool, where they sell 15 or 20%. Manchester City, for example, they've sold 17% to an American investment company, and that raised half a billion pounds. If the Glazers sold 20% of Manchester United, they could probably raise the thick end of a billion. And in doing so, that could provide the vast majority of the funding required to revamp Old Trafford. Yeah, my personal view, as somebody that goes to Old Trafford on a regular basis as an away fan, is the best course of action is to follow the Spurs model, is to knock it down, is to start all over again and make it a future-proof stadium. There's no reason why it couldn't be 85, 90,000 seats. They would sell that out every week. They could have as many corporate boxes as they want. They could then utilise the stadium for things other than football on a more regular basis and really start to monetize it. But you know, that's clearly a decision for other people to make.
But that's a minimum of 10 years, Kieran, isn't it? By the time you acquire the land and get the stadium built, I'd have thought.
I think it could be done a wee bit bigger. Right. A wee bit quicker. Good grief, yeah, it's late at night.
Not only for you, Kieran. So, it's if you didn't get up so early in the morning, Kieran, this wouldn't be late at night for you.
That's true. I do get up at 5 o'clock to check company's house, of course. What else is there to do in the morning? So I think that's where we are. Would it be 10 years? I think it could be done quicker than that. You know, Spurs were only at Wembley for 2 years, remember? Two and a half?
Oh, that's true, I suppose. Yeah, that's true. So yeah, also to finish on that, Kieran, you're saying that Jim Ratcliffe, one of the wealthiest men that the UK has ever seen, probably can't afford to buy Man United on his own.
I think Sir Jim Ratcliffe has the assets to do it. I don't think he has the cash. A lot of his wealth is tied up in Ineos itself. Right. So I don't think he would be able to rustle up the physical cash to make that deal go through without having to raise funds elsewhere.
Meanwhile, Kieran, fans of another United are biting their nails for a completely different reason. This gig I did the other night was headlined by the wonderful Terry Alderton, who used to be on the books at Southend, and there was a group of Southend fans in the audience, including an Essex-based journalist, and they're very sombre. I wish I was able to give them some better information than I could, because it's looking grim, isn't it, for Southend?
It is, yes. I think there's a genuine concern here in the sense that the owner of Southend, Ron Martin, who historically has kicked the can down the road on many an occasion when there's been people saying we've not been paid, and the only sort of grain of hope that I can give to Southend United fans is that he does enjoy brinksmanship. And what we've effectively got is, I think it's on the 1st of March, there's a winding up order from HMRC in respect of unpaid taxes. I think it's somewhere in the region of £1.4 million.
Yeah.
And the judge has said, Ron Martin, you've asked for extra time to pay this. This is your last chance. Now, Ron Martin says, I'm going to make efforts to try to raise the funds, to pay the tax, to keep HMRC off the back of the club, and therefore it will continue in existence. But we're hearing stories about players going unpaid. Away trips, how they're being funded is nobody's quite sure how because I think the coach company and the transport company, they say, well, you know, we ain't prepared to go and supply you on credit. And there's a huge sense of unease. And, you know, Southend United, they're in the fifth tier of English football, but they get cracking crowds, as many clubs in the National League do. It's a proper decent sized town as well. As somebody that used to live in Chelmsford, with my mum and dad, we used to get the train from Chelmsford to Southend for that was our big day out. And going along Southend Pier, and the football ground was proper London expats lived in Southend. So it's a proper good town. And it'll be a huge waste because there's nothing near it either. Mm. You know, the nearest club is Colchester.
Yeah.
So it's not looking good.
I believe Uncle Terry made his first fortune standing underneath the roller coaster waiting for money to fall out of people's pockets. What I don't understand, Kieran, and I wish with hindsight that I'd asked Tom Murray, the lawyer, this in our interview this week, which was very good. But what, talking to the Southend fans, they're saying all the local rumours are that Ron Martin isn't going to pay the tax. He has a buyer. These are rumours, of course. He has a buyer for Roots Hall, which will be developed, and he'll make more money. But if he's declared insolvent or goes into liquidation, how would he then be allowed to sell Roots Hall? That's what I don't quite understand. What's in it for him to not pay the tax? I don't get it.
Right. I mean, I think we have to separate the owner from the football club.
Right. Okay.
Ron Martin will not go bankrupt on the back of this,
right?
Because
he is
a separate legal identity from the football club itself.
I see.
So if there's a winding up order, then somebody will be appointed by the court to sell the assets of the football club, and the biggest asset is Roots Hall. Now it could be that Ron Martin will then come and say, well, I'm going to put in a very decent bid for Roots Hall.
Oh my God!
Which is going to be higher than anybody else. I'm trying to get planning permission. Although I think there's been issues in terms of the planning permission he's put to the local council to date, and this is there's some uncomfortable sort of nooks and crannies when it comes to local planning permission. I know there's huge issues at present in respect of Yeovil Town, for example, in terms of Huish Park. Mm. So it could be that he's in a confident position that he will be able to bid the highest price for the property assets. Then, as he won't have to pay the taxes, you know, the tax authorities will get a percentage of what's owed to them, and he can go ahead with this development. And you talk to people who are connected to Southend United. Yeah, we know some high-profile Southend United fans, and they all say the same thing. You know, this has been his master plan for years and years, that he was going to make his fortune from the redevelopment of the football ground and relocate it. But he's managed to do neither to date. But he, you know, this could be some sort of last Machiavellian throwing of the dice.
Yeah, I regret with every fibre of my being that I'm asking a man to see sense, but please God, come the 1st of March, he does pay that tax, because it's a conversation. We'll be talking to Tracy Crouch later this week, and it's a conversation we need to be not. I'm getting cross. I'm genuinely getting cross, because we need to be not having these conversations in 2, 3, 4 years' time. It's just not right. There are two stories, Kieran, we have now about Stadia, correctly, Stadia. And to be perfectly honest, when the first one came through, when producer guy sent the email with the stories on, I had to check the date, because I thought this must be the 1st of April, and that wacky old Kieran and Guy, let's see if Kevin reads this out without double-checking.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm willing to accept. I want to hear you say it, Kieran, because apparently Bolton Wanderers have signed a new 5-year stadium naming rights deal with a Bolton-based building product manufacturer called, Kieran,
Tough Sheet.
So it's going to be the Tough Sheet Stadium.
It's going to be the Tough Sheet Stadium. That's right. And it's going to be I'd heard it's going to be a very lucrative deal as well.
It would need to be, Kieran, wouldn't it? It would need to be.
Yes. And I love the fact that, you know, we've seen the people at the signing ceremony. I think everybody's in on the joke as well.
It's hard to miss the joke, Kieran.
Yes.
To be perfectly honest, my father-in-law had very little, God bless him. He didn't have much of a sense of humour. He would have got it.
Yes, so it's I believe it's a 7-figure deal, which is
okay. Well, that is decent,
very good.
Yeah,
for a because I hate to say it, I still call it the Reebok.
Yeah,
and I know it's then became the Macron, and it then became the University of Bolton Stadium. And I can assure you, the University of Bolton wouldn't have paid a lot of money for the naming rights. And we've always said this, and this is a big issue as far as Spurs are concerned. That they go at huge lengths to get the media to refer to it as the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, because whoever gets the first naming rights gets, you know, it will always be the Rico, it will always be the Reebok, it will always be the Emirates, it will always be the Etihad, as far as fans are concerned. To be the fourth or the fifth naming rights sponsor and get a deal of this magnitude, if the figures I've been told are correct, is a hell of an achievement. There will be puns aplenty. There will be when somebody gets a last minute equaliser or a penalty is saved or whatever. I'd imagine it's a joke which will pale quite quickly as well.
Oh, I don't know. We've both got quite a childish sense of humour. I still call it the Reebok until about 3 o'clock this afternoon when I got the email. And from now on, it's nothing but the tough sheet. And I'm going to be manufacturing news stories every week just so I can... Jeff Stelling is going to have the best 3 weekends of his life on Sky. It's just, every 2 minutes it's going to be. We're going over to the tough sheet. It's fun. But the second stadium story, Kieran, involves a club we've spoken about quite a lot recently, and it's on the face of it seems to be a good story, but when you delve into it a little bit more, it's slightly mystifying.
Yes, this is Scunthorpe United, a club who were on our rotation list a bit too often until a sort of a month or two ago when the new owner came in. And we saw on Tuesday something came up on the Scunthorpe United website, and it's a chance to own the club stadium. And you go, well, that sounds good. Mm. And then Scunthorpe United, who are not by the coast, by the way, just to remind myself, Scunthorpe United, Glanford Park. The club started in 1899, so this is called the 1899 Club, and there's going to be a chance for 1,899 people to pay £1,899 each, and they will get one share in the company that owns the club stadium. And you go, well, that's a good way of raising it. And you sort of, you do the math, and it's sort of, that's the thick end of £4 million, which could be raised from this. And you go, well, that could be very good. And then I go, well, let's just check Scunthorpe's accounts. And the thing is, Scunthorpe sold their stadium in 2021. So they sold their stadium to a company called Cool Silk, which was owned by the club's former owner, Peter Swan. So what exactly does this involve, and what are fans getting in respect of if the football club doesn't own the stadium? Then there's talk of a 999 year lease. Does that mean that this company Cool Silk is going to lease the stadium? Is there going to be a new company set up? And the more that you read what's on the website, and if you do become one of these investors, it doesn't include your match ticket, but you do get to sit in one of the stands, which you'll sort of have a bit of a hospitality area, and they say, well, you will pay no more than the price of a cheapest season ticket, and you'll be able to transfer these shares. But I'm just sort of thinking, Scunthorpe, they normally get crowds of, perhaps 4,000 if they're doing well, 4,000 to 5,000. It's not an area of significant wealth. So, at a time of economic struggle, how are you going to find 1,900 people willing to pay £1,900 for a share in something that the football club itself doesn't own? Mm. And it just makes you feel this. I think there's lots of questions which need to be asked, and I think to be fair, the fans trust is going to approach the club and with a long list of questions and to try to get some clarity here. But looking at as it is, I think you'd be very reluctant to recommend such a payment. But also, you know, are there 1,899 people in Scunthorpe that have that spare cash to be able to do this?
It almost smacks of the Springfield monorail in The Simpsons somehow, doesn't it?
But yes.
As usual, we would say this, if anybody from the Fans Trust or from the club wishes to clarify what's going on, we'd only be too pleased to talk to them. Two more stories, Kieran. Both of them have the word shameful in, because one of the shamefully few female executives in English football is leaving to become one of the shamefully few female chairs in football.
Well, yes, it's not quite football. This is Debbie Jevons, who has been involved with the EFL for a few years now, and she has come in for a lot of stick from Bury fans historically. A lot of Bury fans feel that she was partly responsible for the demise of the club in terms of her role at the EFL. I personally think that's very harsh. She effectively inherited a mess, and it was too late to try to turn things around as far as the club was concerned. But yet she will be leaving the EFL, and she's going to Wimbledon Tennis, not AFC Wimbledon, I think. And she did try to progress things at the EFL in my view. So she made a contribution. She wasn't able to save Bury Football Club. But nobody was able to save Bury Football Club. It was such a mess. You know, I know some of the people that were involved who were trying to buy the club from Steve Dale, and Steve Dale was impossible to deal with. And I think what happened in respect of Bury was indicative of the governance problems in football, which necessitates an independent regulator. And you know, we are hoping to have news on that. And you know, we have spoken to Tracy Crouch. I think it's fairly well known that the government is planning a white paper, and there's a fair chance that will be announced on Thursday. And if it is announced on Thursday, we're hoping to have a long chat with Tracy when her diary is free, and we are on the case.
Yes, we are. See, that this is my fault. I really should do a bit of research on these questions, Kieran, shouldn't I? Rather than leaving it all to you, I just assumed it was AFC Wimbledon. But so now, Kieran, we could retake that opening line, but it's 8:10. You need to go to bed.
Yes.
So we'll carry on, shall we?
yes.
The last story, Kieran, and this is a story that you and I, we haven't spoken about this much on the show, but I know you and I both share an anger about the fact that there are some people, some despicable people, who are willing to exploit the hopes and dreams of young children who want to become footballers. And hopefully they're about to be called out.
Yes. This is a report in one of the newspapers. This is because there are people who are setting up academies, football academies, which have no affiliation to football clubs, but they are then saying that, oh yeah, we've got contacts with scouts, we've got contacts and relationships with football clubs, and come along, and we'll charge you up to £1,000 for your offspring to get some training. I'm not saying that they don't get any training, but they're selling a hope, they're selling a dream, and the vast majority of the times it's a complete fabrication. It's a fraud, and you have to pay your registration fees, and you've got to pay more for kit, and the parents are suckered in. Professional football clubs do have academies, and they go down, you know, right to the, you know, very, very low ages of kids, but they don't charge.
Yeah.
Because of the whole, one of the great things about football is it is one of the true meritocracies as an industry, because, you know, I know working in the world of finance that there are people in positions due to who their parents are, who their contacts are, and so on. And you can't get away with that in football, because there's nowhere to hide. So that's part of the reason why I do love football. It's a very democratic industry in terms of those who play. It is open to all. It's got a much higher proportion of people who have come from state schools than other, many other industries. And that's something which should be championed. But the fact that we've got people saying, well, football is now ridiculously popular. You know, we got to be honest, it's more popular than any point probably in our lifetime. Yeah, you know, we remember I remember going to crowds of, you know, this was when Brighton were in the old First Division. We sometimes had crowds of less than 10,000. Mm. And you look at some of the stuff which goes out on social media in terms of attendances in the mid to late 80s, and you're absolutely shocked in terms of what clubs can generate. And football, it has improved itself. And the part of the reason for that is the Premier League, which has, I know it's gentrified fans and it's brought a different audience, and much of that is to be applauded. It's made it a much broader demographic, but that means that there's people out there that are trying to take opportunities, and as such, these private academies, all I would say is to anybody that is either approached, gets a flyer through their door, sees something on Facebook or social media, professional football clubs themselves don't go around doing these things. If your child is good at school, then the chances are they will be seen. If they're playing in a local local minis league, they will be seen by scouts, and that will be fed back. Don't be suckered into thinking that somebody who approaches you to say, your kid's really good, I can see, you know, he's got the potential to be the next Harry Kane, or she's got the potential to be the next Rousseau, or whatever it's going to be. Don't be fooled by that, because these people are just after your money.
I remember, Kieran, in the early to mid-80s, thanks almost entirely to the efforts of one Alan Mullery, Esquire, when we were playing in front of 4,500 people at home. And even they were only turned up to boo him on and to boo him off at the end of the game. To be fair, Kieran, this is an area that I have done some research in recently, and I've been to a fairly decent sample of Premier League Championship club websites and teams outside the top two divisions. All of them say exactly what you say. We will find, if your boy or girl has some talent as a footballer, we will find them, and we will approach you. We will never ask you for money. And all of them to a club have a disclaimer saying, do not talk to anybody who approaches you on our behalf. Double check any email headings, double check any headed note paper you might have, ask them for identity, because there are a number of people out there who are operating basically a fairly decent scam. And like you say, they are given some training, but these people have no connection to the clubs whatsoever. And I really hope that this new report is the start of making sure that these people are rooted out of the game, because we are talking about children here, Kieran, basically. Yeah. We've mentioned Tracy Crouch several times in the Independent Review. We are talking on Wednesday. The white paper is due to be published at 12:30 tomorrow, Kieran, I believe. Is it?
I think it's, yeah. We're hearing rumours of that. Fingers crossed. It'll be out, sort of late morning or just after midday.
I imagine, I was going to say you've been in your sleeping bag outside company's house, but I imagine you've already Uncle Terry's probably got your copy somehow already. But not long after it comes out, we will be talking to Tracy Crouch, the author of the white paper, or the fan-led review that led to the white paper. And that interview will be going out separately on Friday. Thanks to everyone, meantime, who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to join them and make a small monthly contribution to the pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, then email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And before poor sleepy Kieran nods off at his laptop, I shall hand you over to him for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you, as always, for the support for the show and all the kind words you send us. Patreon is one way, and we really appreciate your commitment. We appreciate, you know, we know that you don't have to do it, and you choose to do so as a way of showing some support for the show. Another way of supporting the show is to go on to your app that you use to download the podcast and to give us a review and give us what you think we're worth. And as far as the commentary is concerned, I believe the commentary doesn't impact upon Apple's algorithms or where we are in the charts. But so therefore you can effectively write whatever you want. And, you know, to celebrate the great man returning to the top of the ICC bowling rankings at the age of 40, you could even say you would rather have it presented by Jimmy Anderson and Brett Anderson of Suede.
Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Two handsome men. I don't think I've ever seen anyone as cross as Jimmy. You know, fast bowlers, Kieran, legendarily are not.
Oh yes,
the cheeriest of men. We were filming a League of Their Own special in which a scratch team of basically writers, researchers, and James Corden were playing against a team. Included Jimmy Anderson, and James Corden accidentally had Jimmy Anderson caught with slip. Both sets of stumps went over. he nearly went for Freddie Flintoff, who was on the floor, doubled up, laughing. Literally, it took about 4 hours to talk him into carry on recording. Bless him. But he's a really nice player. There's something about fast bowlers, but what a servant he's been to his country and to his county. Wow. I'm going to miss him so much. It's just a joy to watch.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking forward to the Ashes now. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.